A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
So here's what Daniel wrote us. Quote, yesterday we touched on back-end optimization and caching, but one technology seems to come up over and over again whenever people discuss high-performance web applications, Redis. I'd love a deep dive from the ground up. What problem was it originally created to solve? Who created it? And what was happening in web development at the time that allowed it to become so influential? How did it go from being one of many open source infrastructure projects to becoming almost the default answer whenever people mention caching? How did it go from being one of many open source infrastructure projects to becoming almost the default answer whenever people mention caching? He's not done. There's more. How does it differ from a traditional relational database like PostgreSQL or MySQL, and from document databases like MongoDB? Why is RAM such an advantage, and what trade-offs come with storing data primarily in memory? More fundamentally, what actually is Redis? People often describe it as an in-memory key-value store, but that doesn't really explain why it's so useful. How does it differ from a traditional relational database like PostgreSQL, and from document databases like MongoDB? Why is RAM such an advantage, and what trade-offs come with storing data primarily in memory? I'd also like to understand where Redis fits into a modern application architecture. At what point does a project genuinely benefit from introducing Redis? My impression has always been that it's something you weave into a stack once you've reached a certain level of scale or traffic, rather than something every small application needs from day one. Is that impression accurate? Or is Redis just as useful for modest projects, because it solves latency problems that appear much earlier than people realize? What operational costs, consistency concerns, or failure modes should developers understand before adding Redis to their stack? He goes on, please walk through the most common real-world use cases beyond simple page caching. Talk about session storage, API response caching, rate limiting, queues, pub/sub messaging, distributed locks, leaderboards, counters, and any other patterns that have made Redis such a foundational building block.
It really is. And the origin story is the best place to start because it answers the why does this exist at all question before we get into data structures and use cases. So, 2009. Salvatore Sanfilippo, everyone calls him Anti-Res, is running an Italian startup building a real-time web analytics product. Visitors, page views, all that streaming in constantly. His database is getting hammered with writes. Traditional disk-based storage just can't keep up with the volume of incoming data, and he needs sub-millisecond responses to make the dashboards feel live.
The classic, my database is on fire, origin story.
The best kind. And here's the key detail. He doesn't set out to build a database. He builds a solution to one specific problem. He writes a single C file that holds data in memory and lets you push items onto lists and retrieve them fast. That's it. Agreed. So, Salvatore Sanfilippo goes by Anti-Res online. He's a Sicilian programmer, and back in 2009 he was building a real-time web analytics tool called LLOOG.
What was happening in web development at that exact moment that made it catch fire?
Nothing off the shelf did exactly what he wanted, so he wrote a single C file that held key-value pairs in RAM and flushed to disk periodically. Pages weren't static HTML anymore, they were applications. And every time you add interactivity, you add latency. You're querying databases on every request, rendering templates, computing results. A single C file. He posted it on Hacker News, and people immediately saw it wasn't just a cache, it had data structures, lists, sets, sorted sets. That's the part that's hard to overstate.
So the demand for speed created the market, and Anti-Res had already built the thing.
You could push to a list, intersect sets, get the rank of an element in a sorted set. All atomically, all in memory. But Redis wasn't just a dumb cache. It understood data structures. You could store a list and push to it and pop from it and trim it, all with atomic operations. You could store a set and do intersections and unions. Completely literal. And that timing, 2009-2010, the LAMP stack was everywhere. MySQL was the default, and web apps were getting more interactive. People were building Twitter clones, real-time dashboards, chat systems.
Let's sit on that distinction. What does it actually mean that Redis understands data structures versus something like Memcache that just stores blobs?
Okay, imagine you're building a leaderboard for a game. Remote Dictionary Server, R-E-D-I-S. He said in interviews he just wanted something short and pronounceable. That's a read-modify-write cycle with no atomicity guarantee. Two players updating simultaneously can clobber each other.
What? The most loved database on Stack Overflow's developer survey for something like 5 years running.
Yeah, it topped that survey for years. And it's not a database in the traditional sense. That's the distinction Daniel's asking about. PostgreSQL and MySQL are disk-first. Their entire architecture assumes data lives on disk, and memory is a cache layer on top of that. Every write involves writing to a write-ahead log, updating indexes on disk, managing pages.
So the intelligence lives on the server side, not in your application code.
That's exactly the right way to think about it. Redis is a data structure server. It's closer to a programming language's standard library than to a database. Completely. Redis is memory first. Data lives in RAM. Persistence is the afterthought, something you bolt on via snapshots or an append-only file.
How does that compare to something like PostgreSQL?
Radically different model. PostgreSQL stores data on disk in pages. It sounds like one, but it's the opposite. Because everything is in RAM, individual operations take microseconds. A single thread can handle 100,000 operations per second without breaking a sweat. And because there's no locking overhead, no context switching, no contention, you get predictable latency. The bottleneck in a Redis instance is almost always network bandwidth, not CPU.
So the simplicity of the execution model is what makes it fast, not despite being simple.
Compare that to PostgreSQL processing, a simple key lookup. Even if the data is in the buffer cache, you've still got to parse SQL, plan the query, check permissions, navigate a B-tree index, handle MVCC visibility rules. Each step is fast, but they add up. Redis just hashes the key and reads the pointer. That's it. The trade-off is, you lose everything PostgreSQL gives you. Relationships, constraints, durability guarantees, the ability to ask arbitrary questions with SQL. But you gain raw speed. A Redis GET takes microseconds. Right. And that leads straight into the trade-off Daniel asked about. The obvious one is capacity. RAM is expensive. A terabyte of RAM costs dramatically more than a terabyte of SSD. So Redis is for hot data, the stuff you need right now.
But MongoDB?
MongoDB sits somewhere between. It's a document database that persists to disk, supports rich queries, indexing, aggregation pipelines, and some transactional guarantees. Documents are stored as BSON, which is a binary JSON format. Yes, if the power fails, anything written since the last snapshot is gone, unless you've configured the append-only file with synchronous flushing, which slows things down. Redis gives you knobs for this. You can prioritize speed and accept some data loss, or prioritize durability and accept lower throughput. But it's never going to give you the same durability guarantees as PostgreSQL with synchronous replication.
Which means the mental model isn't Redis instead of Postgres. It's Redis in front of Postgres.
That's the canonical pattern, Redis as an acceleration layer. Your source of truth is still the relational database. Redis holds derived data, cached data, ephemeral data. If Redis loses everything, the application might slow down or drop some non-critical state, but it shouldn't corrupt your business data.
Okay, so let's get into the use cases Daniel listed. He mentioned session storage, and I think that's actually the one most people encounter first without realizing it.
If you've ever logged into a web app, your session is probably in Redis. The alternative is storing sessions in the database, which means every single page request triggers a session lookup query. On a busy site, that's thousands of queries per second doing nothing but, is this cookie still valid? Redis handles that with near zero latency, and it can set TTLs on keys so sessions auto-expire.
Unless you configure persistence.
Right. Redis offers two persistence mechanisms. RDB snapshots periodically write the entire dataset to disk as a point-in-time dump, and AOF, the append-only file, log every write command as it happens so you can replay them on restart. It's a first-class feature. Every key can have an expiry. That alone eliminates an entire class of application code. And even with both enabled, you can still lose data from the window between the last write and the last sync to disk.
Which is why most people use Redis as a cache, where losing data is annoying, but not catastrophic.
You cache the JSON response in Redis with a key like sales report, Q3, and a TTL of 5 minutes. The first user waits 2 seconds. Every user for the next 5 minutes gets it in under a millisecond. That's an acceptable failure pattern for most applications. It's not acceptable for your bank balance.
So the mental model is, Redis is a performance layer, not a storage layer.
It gives you the tools. You can delete keys programmatically, use pattern matching, set short TTLs, but the logic of when to invalidate is still your problem.
The famous Phil Carlton quote, "There are two hard problems in computer science, naming things, cache invalidation, and off-by-one errors."
And Redis handles the caching part beautifully. It's the invalidation strategy that separates the adults from the children. When the most respected engineering organizations in the world all adopt the same tool and blog about it, everyone else follows. But the deeper reason is that Redis is easy to deploy. It's a single binary. You download it, run it, and it works. It's practically the platonic ideal of a Redis use case. You need to track how many requests a user has made in the sliding window, and you need to do it for every request without adding latency.
Compare that to setting up a PostgreSQL cluster.
That's two Redis commands, incr and expire, and they're atomic. Doing this in PostgreSQL would mean an upsert with a timestamp comparison on every single API call. It'd work at low volume, but at high volume, it's a lot of write pressure for something that's fundamentally ephemeral. The operational cost of adding Redis was lower than the engineering cost of optimizing the database queries.
Which brings us to Daniel's question about when a project benefits from Redis. He suspects it's a scale thing. You add it once you've outgrown your database.
And he's mostly right, but with a nuance. It's not about scale in the sense of millions of users. It's about specific latency requirements that appear much earlier than people realize. It's not a full-featured message broker like RabbitMQ, but for simple job queues, it's remarkably good. The list data type gives you LPUESH and RPOP, push to the left, POP from the right, and that's a FIFO queue right there. Add BroPop for blocking POP, and your workers can sit idle waiting for work without polling. Libraries like Sidekick for Ruby and Celery for Python can use Redis as their backend, and millions of applications do exactly that.
What's the ceiling on that? At what point does a Redis queue become the wrong tool?
When you need advanced routing, message acknowledgements with redelivery guarantees, or when you can't afford to lose a message if Redis crashes. Redis streams, added a few years ago, address some of this. They add consumer groups and message persistence. But if you're building a financial transaction pipeline, you probably want something with stronger delivery guarantees. With Redis, it's a GET command that returns in microseconds. Even for a modest application with a few hundred concurrent users, that difference is visible.
And you get expiration for free.
Built-in TTL. You set the key to expire after an hour or a day or whatever your session timeout is. Redis automatically cleans it up. No cron job, no cleanup script, no orphan session rows accumulating in your database.
Let's run through the other use cases Daniel listed. API response caching.
This is great for things like notifying connected clients of real-time updates. A WebSocket server broadcasting new comment on post 7 to everyone viewing that post. It's not for reliable message delivery. You cache the response in Redis with a TTL. Next time someone asks for the weather in London, you check Redis first. If it's there, you return it in microseconds without touching the external API. And it's astonishingly fast at that. The PubSub throughput in Redis is basically line rate. You're limited by how fast you can push bytes over the network.
Distributed locks. This one feels like it could go wrong in subtle ways.
Oh, it absolutely can. The basic pattern is SETNX. Set the key only if it doesn't exist, with a TTL so the lock auto-releases if the holder crashes. But there are edge cases. What if the lock expires while the holder is still doing the work? What if a network partition makes two clients think they both hold the lock? There's a whole literature on this. The Redlock algorithm, which Anti-Res himself proposed, has been debated extensively. Martin Kleppmann wrote a detailed critique, and the back and forth is worth reading if you're implementing distributed locking in production.
So Redis gives you the primitive, but the correctness is on you.
Always. Redis provides atomic operations. Building correct distributed systems on top of them is a separate skill. It's not Kafka. There's no durability guarantee, no message replay, no partitioning. If a worker crashes after popping an item but before processing it, that work is lost unless you build a reliability layer on top. Sorted sets. They're the killer feature that nothing else had at the time. You store each player's score as the score in a sorted set, and the player ID as the member. ZED adds or updates a score.
Pubza.
Redis channels. You publish a message to a channel, and every subscriber receives it. It's fire and forget. There's no persistence, no delivery guarantee, no acknowledgement. If a subscriber is disconnected, when a message is published, it misses it. Select with order by and limit. Works until you have a million rows and you're running it on every page load. Then you start adding materialized views and cache tables, and suddenly you've built half of Redis inside PostgreSQL. If you need guaranteed delivery, you use Kafka or RabbitMQ.
Distributed locks.
For a page view counter on a high traffic site, that's a disaster. Redis just increments a number. There's a whole debate around this. Martin Kleppmann wrote a famous critique arguing that Redis locks can't guarantee mutual exclusion in the presence of network partitions, and Anti-Res responded with the Redlock algorithm. It's not. I think the better heuristic is, when you need sub-millisecond latency for specific operations, or when you're doing something that's a bad fit for the relational model. A small app with 10 users doesn't need Redis for page caching.
That's an important distinction. Preventing two servers from sending the same email twice versus preventing two servers from processing the same financial transaction.
And the distributed lock use case is where people most often get themselves in trouble by not understanding the failure pattern.
Leaderboards and counters.
If you're just serving CRUD pages with session data, your database can handle that until the query volume actually hurts. All would require a read-modify-write cycle with locking in a relational database.
So across all these use cases, the pattern is the same. Redis gives you atomic operations on in-memory data structures that would require complex, slow, or race-condition-prone code if you built them on top of a disk-based database.
That's architectural cosplay.
You've used that phrase before.
I stand by it. Redis is a solution to a problem. If you don't have the problem, you don't need the solution. PostgreSQL has its own query cache. Modern SSDs are fast. Adding Redis means adding a new service to monitor, backup, secure, keep patched, and debug when something goes wrong. Running Redis in production means you're running another piece of infrastructure. It needs monitoring, memory provisioning, backup configuration, failover setup if you want high availability. Redis Sentinel or Redis Cluster add complexity.
The just use PostgreSQL school of architecture.
Which I have a lot of sympathy for. PostgreSQL can do caching, job queues, PubSub, and rate limiting. It won't be as fast as Redis for those things, but if you don't need sub-millisecond latency, you don't need Redis. Very real. A managed Redis instance with enough memory to hold your working set might cost more per month than your entire database. You have to actually calculate whether the latency improvement is worth it.
Daniel asked about failure pattern.
Several classics. First, the single-threaded nature of Redis. Commands are executed one at a time in the main event loop. A slow command, KEYs on a large dataset, or a big sort operation, blocks everything else. The big one is the cache coherence problem. Your database says one thing, Redis says another. Maybe the cache didn't get invalidated properly. Maybe the invalidation happened, but a write hadn't committed yet.
What's the worst case scenario there?
A developer runs KEYS star in production to debug something. The dataset has a few million keys. Redis is blocked for seconds. Every web request that needs a session lookup or a cached value fails or times out. It's the worst. You end up writing cache-warming scripts, cache-busting endpoints, monitoring for staleness. Each of those is code that doesn't exist if you just query the database directly.
What about the failure pattern where Redis goes down?
Depends how you've architected. If Redis is just a cache, your application should degrade gracefully, slower responses while it falls back to the database. If you've made Redis a hard dependency, say your session store with no fallback, then Redis going down means users can't log in.
And the persistence gotchas.
If you don't configure persistence, a restart wipes everything. The cache is cold, every request misses, and your database gets hammered until the cache warms up. It depends on the eviction policy you've configured. You can set it to reject writes, which is safe, but breaks your application. You can set it to evict keys based on LRU, least recently used, which is usually what you want for a cache. Or you can set it to evict keys with TTLs first, or randomly. The dangerous configuration is no eviction policy with no monitoring, because then Redis just stops accepting writes, and you find out when users start complaining. And AOFF sync policies are a trade-off between durability and performance. Every second fsync loses at most 1 second of data, which is fine for a cache but might not be fine if you're using Redis as a queue.
So the operational knowledge required is non-trivial.
It's not just apt-get install Redis server and walk away. You need monitoring, alerting, backup strategy, failover configuration, memory management, and a plan for what happens when it goes down. Right.
Let's talk about the consistency model. Cache invalidation is famously one of the hard problems in computer science.
The community didn't take it well. You can explicitly invalidate the cache key in your application code when you update the row. You can use a write-through pattern where every write goes to both PostgreSQL and Redis. The reaction was swift. Within days, the Linux Foundation announced Valky, a fork of the last BSD-licensed version of Redis, maintained as an open-source project with major backing from AWS, Google Cloud, and Oracle.
Which in some contexts is fine. A slightly outdated like count isn't the end of the world. In others, it's catastrophic.
And that's the judgment call. The other consistency trap is treating Redis as a source of truth. I've seen startups store user data exclusively in Redis because it was fast and easy, and then lose everything when the instance restarted. Yes, he'd stepped away from Redis development around 2020, spent years doing other things, and the license change brought him back, because he felt strongly that Redis should remain truly open source. He's now working on Redict, which is a community-driven fork focused on stability and the original BSD license principles.
The Redis landscape right now is, what, 3 major variants?
At least 3. The official Redis now source available. Valky, which has the corporate cloud backing and is probably the most active fork in terms of development velocity. And Redict, which is AntiRes's more conservative, stability-focused fork. Plus a handful of others. It's a fascinating moment. The technology is more widely used than ever, but the governance is fragmented. Step 4. Ask whether you can solve it within the database. Better indexing, query optimization, read replicas, built-in caching. Step 5. If the database can't get you below your latency target, add Redis for that specific use case.
Not add Redis, because we might need it later.
For most users, the managed service they pick, ElastiCache, Memory Store, Redis Cloud, will determine which flavor they get, and they may never notice the difference. Meanwhile, the PostgreSQL instance they already had could have handled their traffic for years.
The misconception roundup. What do people get wrong?
That network effect is hard to displace. The just-a-cache. Framing makes people miss the queues, the locks, the leaderboards, the pub-sub, the atomic counters. It's like calling a Swiss Army knife just a blade.
Second misconception, Redis replaces your database.
3. Can you tolerate losing some data if things go wrong? If the answer to all 3 is yes, Redis is probably the right call. If you're answering no to any of them, think harder. If you try to use it as your primary data store without understanding the trade-offs, you'll have a bad time.
Third, Redis is only for big companies.
It's a remarkable piece of software. It'll serve you well for a long time before you need to add anything else. The barrier isn't scale, it's whether you have a problem that matches Redis's strengths.
And fourth, Redis is always fast.
Single-threaded. One slow command blocks everything. Persistence adds latency. Network round trips add up. It's fast in the common case, but always is a dangerous word in systems engineering.
A data structure server that just happens to be fast, because it lives in RAM.
The fact that AntiRes came back to defend the open source version of his own creation, there's something almost poetic about that. The technology outgrew the license, and the creator stepped back in to say, no, this should belong to everyone. We're seeing Redis add more durability features. At some point, the distinction between in-memory cache and database with a huge buffer pool might become academic for a lot of use cases.
The forks. KeyDB is a multi-threaded fork of Redis that emerged after AntiRes stepped back from the project. Dragonfly is a from-scratch re-implementation claiming 25 times the throughput.
Which is fascinating because it challenges the single-threaded assumption that's been core to Redis's design philosophy since day one. Whether those alternatives gain enough traction to unseat Redis as the default is an open question. Redis has the ecosystem, the client libraries, the operational knowledge, the Stack Overflow answers, the muscle memory. That's hard to displace.
The single C file that ate the world and then got forked by its own father.
You said that once, and I still think about it. AntiRes stepped away in 2020, and the project is now maintained by the company Redis Lifted. The license changed, there was community drama, the forks emerged. It's a whole second act to the story.
The most common misconception about Redis is that it's just a fast cache. It's a data structure server. The speed comes from RAM, but the utility comes from the atomic operations on native data types that would be complex and error-prone to build yourself.
The correction, if you treat it as just a cache, you miss the queues, the locks, the counters, and everything else that makes it a foundational building block. But if you treat it as a database replacement, you'll lose data. Know what it is, and know what it isn't.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for making this episode happen.
This has been My Weird Prompts. We're at myweirdprompts.com. Send us your questions, your war stories, your Redis disaster anecdotes. We read everything.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.